at the Vicar Supervisors Conference, held at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, June 8th to 10th, 1966. At the dinner on Wednesday, June 8th, the featured speaker was Professor Raymond Hilgert of the Graduate School of Business Administration, Washington University, St. Louis. Dr. Hilgert's subject was Supervision and Motivation and the Problem of Introducing Change. At this point in the program, he is being introduced by Professor Paul G. Lessman of Concordia Seminary, Director of the Vicar Supervisors Workshop.
But changed his mind and thought St. Louis was it, and he's back to his hometown. He is a native that is St. Louis. He holds a bachelor's degree from Westminster College. He has an MBA and a CBA, a doctorate in business administration from Washington University. His subject matter is motivation and supervision. And we've also asked him to say a little something on the phenomenon of change as it might occur in the lives of the parish and our lives in general. So without further ado, Dr. Raymond Hilgert.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me back there? Okay. That was quite an eloquent introduction. I've got to say that I feel rather flattered to have been asked by Professor Lessman to be with you this evening. It's not often that a Lutheran layman gets a chance to have as an audience a group of Lutheran preachers. And in some respects, I guess I feel like this is my moment of reckoning or retribution, that you have to listen to me for a change. At the same time, I've got to admit that as the day grew closer, there was somewhat apprehension which mounted within me that perhaps I might have been a little bit too hasty in accepting Professor Lessman's invitation. I guess I began to feel very much like the young father-to-be who had just brought his wife to the hospital to register her in the maternity ward. And he was rather nervously considering this when he looked to his wife and he said, "Honey, are you positive that you actually want to go through with this?" Well, you know, that's sort of, you know, the turning back point, and today it was here and there was no turning back. Nevertheless, like the mother in this story, I am happy to be here, and I do appreciate the invitation. And I am very happy and delighted to share these thoughts with you this evening on this topic of motivation and supervision. That's a good idea. Would everybody like to take their coat off? I would. I think it would be helpful anyway. On a Sunday morning, we can't do this, but I think we can do this now. They got help? Right. Okay. My particular orientation is the field of business management, not only in schooling and teaching, but I had several years in a number of companies and management positions. And the subject that I'm going to talk with you tonight is more from the standpoint of psychology and sociology. Professor Lessman told me this evening at dinner that you have touched on the matter of motivation in a very theological orientation this evening. You might say, well, what in the world is there in the field of business management that a business school professor could offer here? Well, I do think that there are some generally accepted principles of motivation and supervision which research findings in the field of business management and psychology and sociology have substantiated. Vicars, after all, are people. And when you're dealing with people, I think you're dealing with some concepts here that have widespread applicability. I've prepared a handout, which I think every one of you has received at this point. which you can use, I think, to follow the gist of my discussion. I might say that what I'm going to go over with you this evening represents sort of a substantial part of a course which we teach in the field of personnel management. But since we're going to do this in a half hour, 45 minutes tonight, we do have an audience that I think is capable of handling this. These handouts do reflect a business orientation, although we will be trying to make the application to the Vickers situation. And finally, is the matter of I prefer a dialogue rather than a monologue. Now, you fellows are in the business of Sunday morning monologues. I've been trying to get my pastor to get more into the area of dialogues on a Sunday. So I would like to see tonight, if at any time anything I say is not clear, that you would interrupt me or raise questions. If you disagree with anything, please stop me, because I would like this to be more of a discussion rather than just sort of a lecture or lecturette. Okay, can you still hear me back there all right or not? Can you hear okay back there? Okay. I think the first thing, whenever you talk about motivation and supervision, you've got to just first of all talk about people. I don't know if you've ever done this recently, but if you, some morning when you're not feeling too good, just look in the mirror and say to yourself, who am I? What am I all about? Where'd I come from? Well, you know, these are ultimate truths that people in your business are always asking. But I came across a statistic just the other day, which from the Population Reference Bureau in Washington, D.C., they tell us that the world's population in mid-1964 hit an estimated 3.3 billion people, and that the Earth is growing at the rate of 40 to 60 million people annually, and by 1980, they estimate there'll be some 4.3 billion human beings on this particular globe. And yet, and this is the amazing thing when you think about it statistically, psychologists and sociologists have pretty well verified and established that no two human beings are exactly alike. We're all different. And this we try to sum up by saying that we have a personality. You know, a few years ago, incidentally, I think most of you are old enough to remember the days when popular music had words. Do you remember those days? There was a song by Johnny Mercer, which was called Personality. Remember that song? Well, personality has been defined as a more or less enduring organization of forces within an individual associated with a complex of fairly consistent attitudes, values, modes of perception, which account in part for an individual's consistency of behavior. Now, that's a rather academic definition of personality, but all it's saying is this: for each of us, there's something unique. Every human being has certain values, attitudes, modes of perception, which is somehow incorporated into a sum total of a human being, and that there is some consistency to this personality. Now, certainly, our personalities change. We're different today than we were when we were children or teenagers, and yet you can recognize in your own existence that many of the values you hold today were ingrained when you were young. Well, personality. Everybody is different. No two human beings are alike. What does this mean? No two Vickers are alike. Don't expect them to be alike. The fellow you had last year will probably be entirely different than the fellow you'll have next year. Why? What determines it? You might even ask this of yourselves as you go along here thinking about this tonight. Where did your personality come from? What makes you what you are? Well, there are a number of schools of thought on this, but I have cited here in this little handout the four principal schools of thought, Maybe you've come across these in various forms, but I just want to highlight these. First of all, you are what you are as a result of your biology or physiology. Now, I don't think it goes without saying too difficult that men are different than women, biologically. And all of us married people know that there are some personality traits that are different depending upon a man or a woman. Or some of my favorite things, for example, psychologists have determined that women, when they talk, for example, use many more words. But you know what? As you all know this, they say less. In other words, they're not as good, they're not as good at putting ideas across. How about IQ? Who's brighter, men or women? Anybody want to take a crack at that? Sure. Anybody know? Actually, there is no basic difference in terms of general intelligence between men and women. However, at the extreme, that is, at the people who are of a high intellect and at the low intellect, in other words, the genius range and compared down to the other end of the extreme, are there more men or women? Yeah. I don't know what that proves, but nevertheless, this has been pretty well determined. Women, however, do a lot better in linguistic skills. Men do better in mathematics. Men psychologically are more stable than women. One of the most interesting findings in regards to this is that there are many more women who attempt suicide. In fact, three times as many women attempt suicide than men. But you know what happens? More men get the job done. Now, perhaps this proves that men are more efficient than women. I don't know. There have been a number of studies as to thyroid glands. You know how many thyroid glands you're supposed to have? You ever count them recently? Anybody have known from your old high school biology course? Well, statistically, you're supposed to have four. Well, it's been determined that you can range anywhere from a low of 2 to a maximum of 12. Now, what's the thyroid gland supposed to have something to do with? Energy, drive, in other words, the ability, the peak capacities that people have. Well, just think of that fellow with the 12 thyroid glands. He might really be a go-getter. But you can't hardly get at that when you're supervising a victor. There are some studies about executives. I don't know whether there have been any studies in regards to preachers along this line, but executives are taller and fatter than the average male of a similar age level. Of course, he also is more prone to what as a result, or at least partially as a result? Heart attack. This is one of the reasons I got out of business and went back to the campus, because college professors, the incidence of heart attack is about one-third that of what it is on a business manager. Okay, these are just a few things. There have been a number of studies that have linked physique to personality. I think we all have the stereotyped image of sort of the jolly fat man and the nervous skinny person. And there was a study made by a professor at Harvard on Harvard students. This is, of course, what makes it a superb study, in which he actually found that there did seem to be some relationship between personality type and body physique. Okay, so our biology has something to do with it. Let me go on to the next school of personality, which is called here, for lack of a better term, childhood determinism. And the great German psychologist Sigmund Freud is the man who's most associated with this particular school of thought. People who take the Freudian point of view believe that the very early years in a person's life are crucial in determining his personality. Of course, they go into many things, some of which are rather sordid. For example, they study the person, how the child was fed, whether he was breast or bottle fed, the amount of feeding, in other words, whether he had sufficient feeding or whether he was somewhat deprived. Toilet training, whether or not the child was able to grow up in a very permissive environment as opposed to a very strict environment. Living conditions, of course, have something to do with this. Anthropologists have studied, for example, in many of the culturally deprived areas, showing that deprivation has a distinct impact and lasting impact upon the psychology of a human being. Well, I don't want to go too much into Freudian psychology. I don't understand much of it anyway. Perhaps some of you have delved into it more than I have. Suffice it to say, however, I think it's been pretty well established that our childhood years do have a very important effect upon our personality. One of my favorite studies is one that was recently published by Victor and Mildred Gertzel, two California research psychologists who investigated the childhood backgrounds of 400 famous world figures, and they found out that more than 75% of these 400 figures that they studied were born into broken homes, poverty-stricken homes, and homes ruled by tyrannical parents. And they are strongly suggesting that if you want to be great, you should choose your parents, but be sure you choose your parents in some sort of a negative fashion. I don't know how true this is, but they give some rather impressive evidence. It may well be that the secret to the vicar assigned to you is locked up in his childhood. But how are you going to get at that? In other words, you don't start asking him, did you have a permissive mother? were you breastfed or bottle fed? The poor guy probably can't remember anyway. And yet, this may be somewhere locked within him as to his personality. Maybe that's the trouble with all of us. We're too normal. Okay, so the second school. Is there any questions or comments, incidentally, as we're going along here? I'm skimming along these. The third general school towards personality determination is what I've called here the situation. Oh, yes, a question. I try to speak a little louder if I can.
I think it'll be over soon.
Okay, so. Sure. That's all right. Yeah, don't talk. Okay. The third basic school, then, is what I'm calling here the situation or immediate environment. And these are the contributions made primarily by our sociological friends who believe that one's immediate experiences are most important in influencing a person's behavior. Or there have been any number of studies along this line. Let me just mention, for example, the relationships of poverty, urban rooming areas, and so forth, with the incidence of crime. Are people born in deprived areas, are they necessarily born with innate tendencies to crime? No. But it is the conditions in which they are surrounded that leads them to these types of antisocial behaviors. There have been any number of studies of teachers, and I might even say I would like to see a study on pastors in this regard. The study was made by a man from the University of Chicago studied the behavior of beginning teachers such as myself, fellows who haven't had too much experience, as compared with teachers who have had 15 and 20 years of experience. Well, what would you think they found out? The fellow who's only taught for a few years, he is still in the business of preparing lectures, being very anxious to please his students. However, the fellow who's been around a long time, he does what? He relies on old, outdated notes. I wonder if preachers do the same thing. Do they, Pastor, or not? Some do and some don't. Well, no. Well, I'm sure it's true that young vicars who are out now for the first time have a distinctly different type of a personality, for the most part, as a result of their lack of experience, than would the experienced minister who has been out in the field for a number of years. One other comment I might make along the same regard, there have been a number of studies that have established that generally the lower the economic class, the greater the amount of mental disorder. Again, this doesn't prove that people who are born in lower economic areas that are innately less intelligent, but they simply do not have the opportunity, for the most part, to develop their mind. Okay, and then right along the same line is the fourth school that I've mentioned here, the culture, our broader environment. People here, primarily anthropologists and social psychologists, point out that a lot of what we are is determined by our broader culture. The fact that we are here in the United States of America some way influences us. The attitudes and values of society are incorporated into our own personality. I just might mention in regards to religion, it has been established that no pagan country has ever developed a free enterprise economic system. The free enterprise economic system would be at odds with a religion which implies control of man's destinies by the state or by some series of impersonal gods. In our society, for example, we believe in the value of an individual. We believe in education. We believe in innovation, change. A lot of societies don't believe in this, and yet we somehow come to accept these as a result of our broader cultural experience. Okay, would anybody like to comment on any of these schools? These are just points of emphasis. What I'm trying to drive at is this. Every one of us is different. Every vicar is different because we all have these determinants within us in different ways. I heard one of the professors at the school say that he likens a human being to a computer. You know, a computer is a rather stupid instrument, really. The computer will only do what it's been programmed to do. Well, in some respects, human beings are programmed. We're being programmed every day by all of these types of things. Okay, what comes out is sort of a product of all of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I was going to lead to something on this. Maybe I can answer it as leading into this and then get back to your question. We know at the same time that individuals are alike in certain ways. For each of us, we can cite certain things which make us alike in certain ways. We have had, for example, here, a common religious heritage. We have certain commonly shared beliefs, don't we? Most of us, I suspect, come from a middle-class environment. In terms of biology, all of us are men, and the male attitude is a little different than the female. The point I was going to try to make is this. When it comes to supervising a person, you can't do much to change his biology, can you? You can tell him, don't get too fat or don't get too skinny. You can't do much there. Well, maybe, you know, at our university, We've got a lot of problems with getting people to get haircuts. We can try to do this. You have that problem on the seminary or not? No. Okay. Taking baths is another problem. We don't have too many of those. Okay. That's one. Okay. You can't do much there. Can you do much about changing an individual's childhood? That's all in the past. What about in terms of the culture itself? How much can you do as individuals to change the broad culture? Very little. So what it really gets down to in influencing a person, an individual, where do you have the best chance to influence a person's personality? In the immediate situation which is confronting them. I think in answer to your question, it would depend on the individual. For some people, it could well be that his biology is the most important thing which determines his personality. A man, if a man is born with an intelligence quotient of the genius level, he's got certain advantages, doesn't he? The fellow who is born at the other end of the continuum, no matter how hard he tries, he's just not going to make it, is he? For others, it might well be the childhood. What's happened in his early years? I know I've heard our pastor a number of times at Christ Memorial say that the most crucial element in his life was a pastor in his very early experience which guided him toward a religious orientation. In other words, this was probably the most crucial thing of all. The culture certainly had something to do with it. Supposing you had been born of Japanese heritage, you think you'd be a Missouri Synod Lutheran? I raise that as a question. Would you care to answer? Sir? It's questionable. So, what I'm saying, it would depend on the individual, but as far as supervision is concerned, it seems to me that at least three of the four spokes here are pretty well beyond doing anything about it. And the place where supervision plays into it is what can the supervisor do in terms of the immediate situation to properly motivate the people that he for whom he is responsible. Does that answer the question or not? Would anybody like to comment or raise any other questions along these lines? Yes? In other words, if you ever just sit down once, and if you have time, and think about your own personality and try to analyze in your own experience what was most crucial in determining your personality. I think at one time I could have told you in terms of my own experience. Now I'm not so sure. I know it's constantly going through some evolutionary process as regards the experiences of the university. I'll give you an example. I'll tell you my political views. I think you should know that. At one time, I was very liberally oriented. I grew up in a home where my father, voted one ticket, the Democratic ticket, all right down the line. Well, the more I've been involved in a business school setting, I've become more conservative. However, I am not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Republican, and I want you to know that. That was supposed to be a joke. A sad joke. Okay. Republicans take heart. Ronald Reagan is the nominee. Okay. Any other comments in this regard? All right. Well, we know, too, that people are alike in certain other ways, and our psychologists have determined human behavior being something that is caused. Maybe some of you have seen or read about the so-called rat experiments that many of us psychologists like to do. You know, get these poor little mice and rats in a maze, and do all kinds of things to confuse them and frustrate them, but they do this, and they learn from these rats. They find, or the dog, maybe some of you have heard of the Pavlovian dog experiments, where they had this poor dog, they would ring this bell, and if the poor dog did the right thing, ran to the right place, he would get rewarded with some food. If he didn't, he would get a swat or wouldn't get anything. And after learning it over and over and over a number of times, they even got to the point where just the ringing of the bell would cause the dog's mouth to water and saliva to form because he had been so conditioned. Well, for many experiments, it has been determined that human behavior is caused. It isn't something that just sporadically shoots out. It's caused. It's goal-oriented. It's motivated. For everything we do, there's usually a reason. Now, sometimes it doesn't seem that way. When my wife gets into a store, I'm sure there's no reason for some of the things that she does. And maybe some of you have experienced this also. But down there in the deepness of her mind, presumably there is a reason for what she's doing. And I think one of the best theories that have come along in recent years to explain human behavior was formulated by Professor Abraham Maslow of Brandeis University, called the theory of the hierarchy of needs. And if you would, if you just turn to the second page on this little handout, this is a diagrammatic presentation of what I think is generally accepted as a pretty good description of human motivational needs. At the lower end of this ladder is what's called the basic physiological needs. These are the needs for food, water, shelter, exercise, the things that we've got to have to stay alive as human beings. You know, the Bible says man does not live by bread alone. That's true. However, when you don't have any bread, what becomes pretty important in most human experience? Getting that bread, doesn't it? In other words, we've got to some way satisfy our physical needs first if we're going to just stay alive. In our society, these have been pretty well satisfied for the great majority of the population. Now, I don't want to say anything too much about the war on poverty, but you know, poverty is pretty relevant, and I think one of the greatest tributes to our particular economic system is the fact that for many of the people who are classified as being in poverty in our society would be the upper or middle classes in many other societies. But nevertheless, poverty is a very serious thing until you can do something about taking care of your physical needs. Once these needs become relatively satisfied, they no longer are the primary motivational force in a human being. The psychologists say it this way: a satisfied need is not a motivator. An unsatisfied need is a motivator. So once the need becomes satisfied, we usually have something else come up as being predominant. And the next need, which seems to be generally accepted as paramount once the physiological needs have been satisfied, or what's known as the safety or security need. You know, we spend an awful lot of time in labor relations. In fact, I know even Senate has done this recently, going through such things as pension plans, medical insurance, hospitalization insurance, you name it. I don't know where it's going to stop anymore. Why? Because once you've got a pretty good life, what do you want to do? You want to hold on to it, don't you? You want to get a little bit more control over the uncertainties of life. Now, life isn't ever certain, but as best you can to derive some security, we try to do it. Are we doing okay? Keep talking? Okay. Again, these are not necessarily ordered directly. You notice on this chart I have a wide range of overlap. At one point in time, these basic needs may become more important. At another point in time, the security needs. Right now, we have a number of labor disturbances in the St. Louis area where people are clamoring for higher wage rates. At the same time, of course, they're asking for greater fringe benefits. These aren't just arbitrary steps, but they are some way ordered. Well, once these become reasonably satisfied, however, another need seems to crop up, and this is what's known as the social need. These are the needs which psychologists describe as needs for belonging, association, acceptance, giving and receiving, friendship, love. For preachers, this is very important, I would suspect. You're very socially oriented, and I would think that every minister of the gospel would crave acceptance from his parishioners, just like a teacher likes the idea of having his students like him. Now, he may have to do things, just like a minister may have to do things, which his people do not like, but yet he does this in regards to his own position. But most of us are social creatures. We like to be recognized among our fellows. We like to be loved. We like to have friends. And then I think the next two go right hand in hand as you climb this hierarchy. The next is what's known as the ego needs, needs that relate to one's self-esteem, for self-confidence, independence, achievement, competence, knowledge, status, reputation, all of these things that all of us, if we're honest with ourselves, really crave. You know, I guess one of the things I enjoy most about giving a talk is simply being asked to give the talk, because this is sort of an ego satisfaction thing with me, that somebody thinks enough of me to ask me to talk. I guess that this is a natural inclination. We like this. We like to be recognized. And at the top of this ladder, and you see that at this top part of ladder, the guy's waving the flag, and here's maybe where we're waving the flag, is the period when you get in life and you say, I have been self-realized. Well, what does this mean? To be self-realized would be you have been able to reach the point where your own potentialities to the fullest have been developed. You're creative in the broadest sense of the word. I think that in our mutual profession, this is what motivates us most of all. Certainly, we're not motivated primarily, I think, by money. I think most of us, if we're honest again, believe that in the profession, the ministry of the gospel, or in my own chosen teaching, we can find our greatest self-fulfillment. By serving Christ, we in turn also can get our own innate greatest satisfaction. And my guess, and I'd like to stop at this point, if I were guessing as to what would motivate the vicar most of all, it would be the desire for ego and self-realization. I'd like to stop at this point and ask you, do you think that Professor Maslow's theory of a hierarchy of human needs makes any sense at all, and do you think it makes any relationship to vicars and ministers? Yes?
Do you think that the principle of Christianity of tries to invert these?
In what way? Christian ideal that
the old Adam idea, the new man idea, the new man tries to invert
Well, I'm talking here in terms of human needs, the priority of human needs. I'd like some of you to answer this. Uh-huh. Gentleman back there in the red tie. I think that's you. I don't know if that's an answer. Mm-hmm. One of the things that along these lines, I think, is established that where a lot of the problems occur in the poverty areas is the feeling of lack of hope, no possibility for change. And so sometimes these things just boil over into the riot atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Yes? Gonna have to feed him, that's right.
And then the last thing you're gonna worry about is whether he realizes that he's there.
Okay.
But I'm kidding, you know, I don't want to pinch you on this.
No, please do.
But this is a stepping stone from primary lead up to what is supposed to be the last thing a man has.
The highest.
Now, is this true with every individual? Or does one individual have a high need for self-respect? Mm-hmm. Is this person a high need for just one thing?
Yes. Very good question. I'm glad you brought it up. Let me say this is a theory of human needs. I think it's pretty well accepted, but it's sort of like Einstein's theory of relativity. It's pretty hard to prove. You know, there have been a number of people who have tried to prove Einstein's theory of relativity. They think he's right. I'll accept it at face value. I'm not about to challenge it. I have a fellow working for me who's a doctoral candidate at the university who, by a small research project at MIT before he came here, gave a series of questions which were supposed to get at this type of thing. In other words, given a circumstance, what would motivate you most? And for what it's worth, it seemed to indicate that perhaps these needs were not ordered as nice and neat as Maslow thinks they are. Maslow also points out that at any given point in time, these things might, you know, get out of kilter. And I'm sure that for any individual, he might well have a different argument. It's just that this is sort of a universally accepted theory of a structuring or hierarchy of needs, which would cut across cultures, cut across personalities on the average. And it's generally accepted, but I don't think it should be accepted in any rigid terms. No, no.
This is in sense of pride. In other words, if you have your choice between self-realization and starving to death, the thing you're going to solve is starving to death.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, in the beginning, you can be conditioned by your environment. You may well have been in a situation of respecting self-esteem and a low culture, and not yet have solved your basic biological needs as far as your knowledge.
Okay, all very pertinent comments. Okay, there, one more. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Can't we think of all of these things in terms of Christ's words? I know you have needed things.
To recognize them and deal with them realistically is really what I'm saying. Or at least what I'm going to be leading to say. Okay, let me go on then if I can, because now we want to get into the problem of supervision. This is a problem which, of course, in personnel management is an eternal problem. Just real briefly, it has not been solved in the field of business management. It's essentially a dilemma. How much authority, how much should you rely upon, if I can use the term as I've used here, human relations? There was a time in business management thought, particularly I'm referring now to this century, the early part of the century up to maybe the middle to late 1920s, where management and supervision was pretty much a matter of authority. Well, I've got also down here theory X and theory Y. I might bring this in right at this point. A professor, a late professor from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Douglas McGregor. How many of you have ever heard of theory X, theory Y? Well, this is a pretty interesting thing. It sounds mysterious, and I think this is why he chose these terms, you know, X and Y, the great unknown. But really, all it was a way of dichotomizing this matter of supervision. The Theory X supervisor was one who relied essentially on the authority of his position, a reward and punishment type of supervision. If someone would get out of line, let him have it. Maybe fire him, discipline him, chew him out as the thing might be. There are many managers who rely on this today and are quite effective at it. Now, I don't know whether any ministers supervise vicars from this approach. It's a matter of extreme. But really, it's essentially the question, how much should I rely on my authority as a supervisor? As opposed to the other end of the dilemma, how much should I really look at this thing from a human relations standpoint? In the mid-1930s, and I guess maybe up to the early 1950s, management research seemed to turn more and more to the focus of, if you could make people happier on their jobs, they will be more productive. They will be more highly motivated. And there were many excesses in this direction where writers would more or less, with misty-eyed type of idealism, say, the way to supervise is, of course, by giving people free rein, letting them more or less do what they want to do, and somehow they'll unconsciously move toward management goals. Similarly, I guess you might say this in supervising of a vicar. Give the man a free rein and somehow he'll do exactly what you want him to do. Well, theory Y is a little modern day version of the human relations approach. McGregor says that's too extreme, but he does believe that a more realistic approach to supervision is one which blends the proper use of authority and what we know about human motivation in terms of trying to get the most out of the individual. And in order to set theory Y into the proper framework, I'd like you to turn to the next chart or series of charts, which reflects two studies. Actually, they were a series of studies. The first was made by Professor Hertzberg of Wayne State University. He actually made this in nine companies in Pittsburgh among engineers and accountants. And the second study, which was very similar, made by a man by the name of M. Scott Myers at the Texas Instrument Company, in which the research was directed at this whole problem of motivation and supervision. It stemmed quite a bit from Maslow's theory of the hierarchy of needs. And the approach taken was to randomly pick people. I mentioned that in the Pittsburgh study, they studied accountants and engineers. In the Texas Instruments study, they studied scientists, engineers, manufacturing supervisors, male technicians, and female assemblers, a total of almost 300, about evenly distributed, and on a randomly selected basis. And then they said to these people in the course of a semi-structured interview, they said this: think of a time when you felt exceptionally good or exceptionally bad about a job, either your present job or any other job that you've had. This can either be a short-range feeling or a long-range feeling. And tell me what happened. This is what the interviewer did, and by a series of discussional questions brought out in the interview, got the person to talk and tell him about the things that motivated him the most and that got him unhappy, or, if there is such a word, demotivated him. Well, without going into all of the findings, I think the bar graph is a pretty good way of summarizing it. On the next two pages, the definitions of each of these variables are given. Some of you may want to look this up or perhaps even go to the original sources to read on it. But what they found, basically, when they talked to people, the things that motivated people the most were very, very closely related to the so-called higher level needs of people. The things that got them most unhappy, the low attitudes, were things that, for the most part, related to the lower level needs. Notice, for example, the things that people said really were associated with making them feel good, wanting to do a good job. Such things as achievement, recognition, the work itself, responsibility, opportunity for advancement. And you can implicitly see to what kind of needs do all of these things refer. Self needs, don't they? Or social needs. In other words, if you're talking about recognition as being something that others observe in you. The things that got them most unhappy and were things that really bothered them were company policy and administration. Well, I might bring that down to the level we're talking about here. The policy administrator in this case would be whom? You guys right there. In other words, the fellow who is what? The boss, the policies that he sets. The supervision, technical. Now this would be how good a technician is the supervisor. In other words, if the supervisor doesn't know the job, what about the guy who's working for him? To start out, unhappy. If you're not a pretty good minister. What about the fellow underneath you? If he recognized flaws in your own behavior, he's going to pick that up, isn't he? Salary. Now, this is an interesting one, and I do want to talk about this, because I think in the field of business management, it's very important. You notice that salary shoots out off here to the right in terms of high attitudes as well as the low attitudes. Would any of you like to take a shot as to why that might be? The only one that sort of beats the theory here, but I think there's an explanation. And this is exactly what was found out. Salary is as much, at least in an industrial setting, many times a matter of recognition as it is what? Actually, the money itself. Now, there's a story in the Organization Man of a big fight at the corporate level between the one man who was getting $35,000 a year as compared to a fellow at the same level who was getting $34,000 a year. Well, what about that $1,000 differential? Peanuts, really. But what did that $1,000 represent? A tremendous amount of ego recognition, and the fellow who was getting the $34,000 was very upset about this, because in his mind anyway, this meant he wasn't evaluated as highly as someone else. Supervision, interpersonal relations. Now this, of course, is the personal relationship apart from the technical supervisory subordinate relationship. And then working conditions. Now, I don't know what working conditions you're going to confront your people with. In the industrial setting, these more refer to all such things as to whether there were fans, noise in the background, so forth and so on. Lack of air conditioning. You know, most of us in business and industry are terribly spoiled. Even over on the campus, we in our particular building at Prince Hall are extremely spoiled. We're one of the few buildings that is completely air-conditioned. Our building was renovated a few years ago. Well, you know, we come to expect it. You know, we just live with it, and we enjoy it. But, it's there. But last summer, during one of the courses that I was teaching, we were without it about 3 days, and it was a rather hot part of summer. You know what I would have thought had happened? That the whole school had fallen apart. Why? That's all people talked about. In other words, no air conditioning. It was just terrible. I mean, all of the other things were forgotten. Now, why? Well, it's kind of spoiled that we're in. How many of you have churches that have air conditioning? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just built a new church out of Christ Memorial that's air conditioned. And, two Sundays ago, it was rather hot and humid, and for some reason it wasn't on. That's all I heard. Nobody talked about the pastor's sermon. You know all they talked about? Why didn't they have that air conditioning on? You know? And are people like this or not? Now, when all through with this analysis, the researchers described it in this way. These types of things in the upper level here were what they call motivators. The things that really got people involved and wanting to do a good job. All of these down here, they call maintenance items. Another writer refers to them as the dissatisfied. If you don't have air conditioning, you're what? You're dissatisfied. If you do have it, are you motivated? Nah, not really. If you have a boss who is a good boss and somebody who really gets along with you, you're not particularly motivated. You expect it. I would think that every vicar would expect every one of you to be very, very friendly, helpful, etc., etc., wouldn't he? But will that necessarily motivate you? It's questionable. But if you're not that way, what about it? He's going to be unhappy, isn't he? Well, you can take any of these others. I don't know about salary. How do you how do you handle this in this situation? I ask you. Do the churches normally?
The churches themselves pay the salary, and they vary, of course, considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the group should know. Mm-hmm. They compare a little bit. We have one pastor this year. I don't think he cares. paying $500 a month plus $75 car allowance. That's pretty high. And of course, this gets around, and it's a little frustrating to others. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How motivated was this fellow? He's probably real satisfied.
He's not motivated, he's jolted.
Okay. But supervision, technical, all of these things, what I'm trying to say is, look, just as in an industrial setting, people expect good supervision. They expect good policy. These are things that in their absence, they're going to be terribly unhappy. But if you really want to motivate people, you've got to give more than just maintenance supervision. You've got to give motivational type supervision. Things that are more involved with their image of themselves. Advancement, responsibility.
And as the foregoing fades out, it brings to a conclusion the remarks, then the discussion of the speaker, Professor Raymond Hilgert, Graduate School of Business Administration, Washington University, St. Louis, speaking on the subject, supervision and motivation, and the problem of introducing change to the Vicar Supervisors Conference being held at Concordia Seminary, June 6th to June 10th, 1966. The Reverend Paul G. Lessman is director of the conference.